shortage. The shortage came after safety issues forced shutdowns at a plant in Michigan earlier this year. Brian Deese, a White House economist, said a consent decree between the FDA and formula producer Abbott is, quote, forthcoming. The expected move comes after the Biden administration faced increasing pressure over the last week to respond to the crisis. And a new analysis reveals that nearly 80 million properties in the U.S. stand a significant chance of exposure to wildfire, according to a model built by the nonprofit First Street Foundation. A Washington Post analysis of the group's data found that an estimated 16% of the country's population today lives in hazardous areas. Over the next 30 years, that share will increase to 21%. Record-breaking heat and drought, fueled by increasing greenhouse gas emissions, are drying out grasslands and forests and lengthening fire seasons. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 78 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 69 degrees and partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
We talk about Shireen. Shireen had love for her people. She loved us. You know why? Because she never allowed the violence against us to happen in silence. Let's say her name. Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen Abu Akleh.
Shireen Abu Akleh.
Protests in San Francisco over the assassination by Israeli military of Palestinian American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh.
When Palestinians call for holding Israel accountable and for boycotting relations with an apartheid nation, we see ourselves being designated and called out as terrorists only for opposing the systematic violations and war crimes that Israel is doing in all across Palestine.
Nakba Day is May 15th. It's recognized annually as a catastrophic day after Israel gained its independence in 1948. We hear about the Palestinian people's struggle for self-determination, land, and human rights.
The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it?
And we remember El Haj Malik El Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X. May 19th is the birth date of Malcolm X, and it's celebrated around the globe. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. In San Francisco on Saturday, hundreds of Palestinian Americans and supporters of Palestinian human and labor rights rallied against the assassination of Al Jazeera's Palestinian American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh by Israeli military forces. COVID, Race, and Democracy producer Steve Zeltzer was at the rally and brings us these voices.
These are just a few of the people who have given their lives for our struggle. And we know that, unfortunately, they are not the last ones. But we know from those of us who are living and standing here today, who come from people who have sacrificed everything so that we can be here, we will never give up on liberation. We will never give up on return. And we will never let what happens to us, to them, happen in silence. We talk about Shireen. Shireen had love for her people. She loved us. You know why? Because she never allowed the violence against us to happen in silence. That's why she comes.
I just spent 3 months in Palestine, and I was organizing there, and it's just so clear what's happening on the ground. It's apartheid, it's occupation, it's ethnic cleansing, all of the above, and the people there, they are just incredible. They have the biggest steadfastness that you can imagine. Their resistance is everything, and I'm here to support them. It's all about power, it's all about politics, the military-industrial complex, and the arms forces that are strong, but we are stronger, the people are stronger. And I'm glad to see the support that's out there, because Shireen was an amazing woman, and we're here standing behind her and standing behind the Palestinian people.
Why don't you talk about her?
Well, my friends in Palestine have been saying that they've followed her since the Intifada, and that she has been their voice. And so for them, this is heartbreaking. It's like losing a family member.
My name is Tongo Isaac Martin. I'm here because what's been going on and continues to go on is nothing less than genocide. And so and we see also that this kind of this rightward march that's trying to catch up with catch up with Israel. Every stand we can take, we have to take it. We have to take it together, because there's going to be no sideline soon.
It seems like the United States says they're fighting for democracy in Ukraine, but when it comes to Israel.
Definitely. I mean, you can really expect nothing but hypocrisy from an imperialist power. You know, what they say is really just a propaganda tool.
And the idea of Zionism, that the Jewish people have a right to be there when Palestinians are being kicked off the land, I mean, what kind of ideology is that?
It's a settler colonial ideology, and we should just go ahead and separate Zionists from Jewish people, because one is a people and the other is some people who subscribe to a settler colonial ideology that's all about just the extermination of whatever indigenous people is there. We've seen the same thing here. We've seen the same thing all over the world, you know.
And the United States is spending billions of dollars on Israel. In San Francisco, you have homeless people. People can't get health care. People can't get housing. Right. Where are the priorities?
The priorities are to maintain ruling class hegemony. Yeah, always has been, always will be, until we put an end to it.
And as a poet, what can artists do with cultural workers around this issue?
Well, we see the importance of culture, man. If you if we put the lens back on, it's kind of more right-wing fascist forces. We see how much of a cultural project that was, right? And so, as far as scaffolding, moments of revolutionary organization or scaffolding struggle, cultural workers are right there to really to normalize a correct analysis. I always got a short poem. Or I got a poem I can make short. I go to the railroad tracks and follow them to the station of my enemies. A cobalt tooth man pitches pennies at my mugshot negative all over the United States. There are toddlers in the rock. I see why everyone out here got in a big cosmic basket, and why blood agreements mean a lot, and why I get shot back at. I understand the psycho-spiritual refusal to write white history and take the glass freeway.
My name is Munadil Herzallah. I'm here representing U.S. Palestinian Community Network, a nationwide organization that have a few chapters throughout the states. The Zionist movement tried to control the Jewish voice in the labor. Therefore, it is very, very parallel to what happened in Israel right now. And they basically diluted the voice of the working families, the work class, and they're part of the machine of the Democratic Party, instead of being a force that built on accumulating victories of the working families. They're like diffusing that and siding with Israel, definitely divert the whole movement towards conservatism. And we have a lot of education to do with our rank and file, meaning that they feel they know exactly what the problem is. And once they discover, they find out that this millions of dollars that's been spent on occupation, and instead of housing, instead of healthcare, instead of issues that is really a matter of interest to the working class, then we will feel the shift. I think they're totally out of touch. They are totally not qualified to represent the working families. You know, all these millions of dollars going to support the military occupation must be stopped.
And there's an effort to shut down discussion, even of resolutions around Zionism in the Labor Council.
Yeah,
it seems like it's right here in San Francisco.
It's not by accident that when the Labor Council initiated a resolution to stop aid to Israel, the council received a memo, quote-unquote, from the AFL-CIO claiming to be that this discussion is not to be taking place in the Labor Council, which is nothing but circumventing the voices of the rank and file and then claiming to be representing the working families.
I'm Saif from the Palestinian Youth Movement. So we're here today to basically mark the Nakba, which is the Palestinian catastrophe, the collapse of Palestinian society in 1948 after the establishment of the State of Israel. We're here to stand in solidarity with Palestinians who have been subjected to an unprecedented level of violence by the Israeli state. We've seen in Gaza in May of last year, we've seen yet another operation against the people of Gaza where over 100 people were killed, mostly civilians, including children. The Strip continues to be subjected to an illegal siege where Palestinians cannot have their basic needs met, where the vast majority of children are suffering from PTSD. In the Negev or the Naqab region, we see Palestinians resisting their ethnic cleansing in response to Israeli plans to forcibly evict them from their ancestral homelands in the Negev Desert. In Jerusalem, we've all seen the scenes in Sheikh Jarrah where Palestinians are fighting to retain the deeds to their homes in efforts to ethnically cleanse them from East Jerusalem in order to fulfill Israel's goal of a so-called Jewish demographic majority, which is not something we expect any democracy to do, to engage in gross ethnic engineering. And we are here today to honor Shireen Abu Akleh, the journalist that was murdered May 11th by the Israeli occupation forces in Jenin. And so that is why we are here today.
And it seems like she's not the first journalist that has been targeted.
Since 2002, there have been 43 journalists that Israel has murdered. And the reason why they murder journalists is because they document Israel's crimes that are plain as day. Journalists are not only murdered, they're subjected to brutal violence by settlers as well, who injure them, who sometimes fire rubber-coated steel bullets on them. And we are here to honor those journalists who have the bravery of documenting Israel's brutal aggression against the Palestinian people.
The role of the United States is arming Israel?
Yeah, so the U.S. sends $3.8 billion a year in military aid to Israel. There are no conditions on this aid. We are calling for the immediate end to this aid. The U.S. claims that Israel is a so-called democracy, but is anything but a democracy. Name me a single other democracy that engages in ethnic engineering where the politicians, plain as day, explain that they have plans to Judaize specific areas, which basically means to bring in settlers of a specific ethnic group at the expense of the indigenous Palestinian people. And the U.S. is complicit in this because Israel carries out the crime of apartheid against the Palestinian people, and the U.S. basically never votes for any resolutions in the United Nations to condemn Israel. It continues to protect Israel from any resolutions that do. So it has diplomatic efforts to protect Israel and has unconditional military aid that is going to the Israeli authorities. So Americans need to know that their tax dollars are going to funding war crimes in Palestine, and that they should pressure their politicians in order to not support Israel any longer. I think it is a fundamentally racist ideology.
May she never be forgotten. May we rise in her honor.
That was a solidarity rally in San Francisco to protest the murder of Palestinian American Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, reported by Pacifica Steve Seltzer.
This is for Palestine, with more love, respect, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. With a shocker taking tears on the place of the laughter. We don't live Palestine, we don't live Gaza. Palestine, with more love, respect, Gaza. This is for the child that is searching for the answer. With a shocker taking tears on the place of the laughter. We don't live Palestine. Palestine.
while we listen to tunes made by ignorant fools. Israel blocked the UN from delivering food. They bring in the troops and you won't even glimpse at the news. They make money off the products that we're quick to consume. And it's not simply a question of differing views. Forget emotions, this is facts, what I spit is the truth. Makes no difference if you're a Christian or if you're a Jew. They're just people living in different conditions to you. They still die when you bomb their schools, mosques and hospitals. It's not because of rockets, please God, can you stop this all? I'm not related to the strangers on the TV, but I relate, cause those strangers could have been me. Words could never ever explain the raw tragedy. It's not a war, they're just murdering more rapidly, and we're automatically supporting pure savagery. Imagine how you feel if this was your family.
Long Live Palestine by Low Key. This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe. Nakba is May 15th, is recognized annually for the catastrophic day after Israel gained its independence in 1948. Malina Ansari spoke with COVID, Race, and Democracy producer Ken Yell about the repression of Palestinian people since that day and their ongoing struggle for self-determination, land, and human rights. Malina Ansari is the International Advocacy Officer for Otomir, an organization Israel has banned and labeled as terrorist because it advocates for Palestinian political prisoners.
My name is Melina Ansari. I'm the International Advocacy Officer at Al-Damir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association, which is basically a Palestinian non-governmental civil society and human rights organization that focuses its work on advocating on behalf of Palestinian political prisoners held both in Israeli occupation prisons and the Palestinian Authority as well.
We're having this conversation near Nakba Day, May 15th, which this year commemorates 74 years of occupation and displacement of the Palestinian people by an apartheid Israeli state. Of course, none of this could have happened without the full support of the U.S. and the European colonial powers. And yet all we hear in the news in this country day after day for the last 2 months is the same U.S. and European powers shedding crocodile tears about the brutality of occupation and the displacement of Ukrainian refugees. And I just have to wonder how it feels to be a Palestinian in this especially hypocritical moment.
This time actually makes it very clear the hypocrisy of politics, exactly like you mentioned. But I would start my answer with a more positive note. In May 2021, the Palestinians began this unity uprising where it was in the face of what the Israeli occupation was doing in Jerusalem regarding Damascus Gate and Sheikh Jarrah, with the forcible displacement of family members in Sheikh Jarrah to continue on giving privileges more to Jewish Israeli settlers and encouraging settlements to grow even in Jerusalem. So we saw the rise of this unity uprising where Palestinians in the West Bank, Palestinian in Gaza, in the occupied 1948 territories and Jerusalem, all united together. And we even saw great solidarity with the Palestinian people in the diaspora. So the Palestinian United Together were able, in a way, to focus the media attention and focus any attention on what's happening in Jerusalem. So this, in a way, gave us a bit of an idea how when fragmentation is always implemented and strengthened by the Israeli occupation, we use the power of the unity of the Palestinian people. And now with the Nakba Day coming ahead, we celebrate again more than 70 years of the project that now looks like an apartheid regime. But in the beginning, Israel was established as a settler colonial regime. And still 17 years later, we see the expansion of settlements grow day by day. And we see Israel's annexation plan grow day by day as well. In November 2021, the Israeli authorities designated six Palestinian civil society organizations as terrorist organizations under its own counterterrorism law. The six organizations work with prisoners, women in Palestine, children, farmers and peasants, researchers, and all violations of international law. And we have Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch to recognize Israel as an apartheid regime. But yet we see U.S. tax money constantly financing the military regime on Palestine. And here is when we say now is the time. I mean, with the Russian-Ukraine situation, states were so quick to sanction Russia. They were so quick to boycott any relations with Russia for its violations of international human rights. However, when Palestinians call for holding Israel accountable and for boycotting relations with an apartheid nation, we see ourselves being designated and called out as terrorists only for opposing the systematic violations and war crimes that Israel is doing in all across Palestine.
And your organization, Adamir, focuses on systemic violations against Palestinian prisoners. What is most important for our listeners to understand about these prisoners?
The movement of Palestinian prisoners is the only time you really see Palestinians united together without any geographic or political fragmentation. Inside prisons, Palestinian prisoners are unified. They work collectively. And we have seen this in a beautiful way following the Galboa escape last year, where six Palestinian prisoners were able to escape from the Galboa maximum security prison. But they were recaptured by the Israeli occupation, and the Israeli prison services started initiating a series of collective punishment against those affiliated with those prisoners who escaped. But we saw the prisoner movement from inside all work together against this collective punishment against the specific prisoners. And really, this is what we emphasize on. Like, all Palestinians are subjected to this arbitrary arrest. Israel does not exempt any Palestinian, regardless of gender or age. We are all at risk of this arbitrary arrest and this murder by the Israeli occupation. Whether it's children, women, elderly, civil society, or journalists, or human rights defenders, it is an issue that Israel uses to maintain control. Our main goal is definitely not to better the detention conditions for prisoners or better the fair trial standards in military courts. Our goal here and our aim is that no Palestinian is detained solely to maintain control over them, because prisons are used by the Israeli occupation to cut any hint of hope for Palestinians to live in liberty and dignity. Inside prisons, they are subjected to physical and psychological torture that makes it very impossible to still believe in a liberated Palestine. But prisoners, Palestinian prisoners, are a symbol of courage and resilience and resistance. So that is why we need to focus on ending the mass incarceration of Palestinians solely for the reason to delegitimize their rights and really violate any right to live in liberty and dignity. And the Israeli occupation has made this apartheid regime as if it is the murderer and the judge and the jury at the whole same time. So Palestinians can never find true justice and true accountability from military courts or from Israeli civil courts. We need the international community to abide by its moral and legal obligation to protect Palestinian rights in the context of the globalization of human rights, and not only because of Palestine. This is an intersecting struggle, and it needs unity in order to stop it and hold Israel accountable.
What would you say to those of us who would like to support Palestinian political prisoners and the Palestinian struggle more generally?
One thing is the designation of the six organizations is something that many organizations in the United States have stood up against. So the Stand with the Six campaign, that you can find all the resources for it on www.palcivilsociety.com. But what's really important to me is also focusing on the root causes and the broader picture of the Israeli settler colonial regime. So we believe now is the time that the international community stops the silence and this impunity to Israel and start recognizing it as an apartheid regime and settler colonial project. Why are US and American tax money being the main reason and support to finance the Israeli military regime that constantly kills Palestinian children, that has a land, water, and air siege on Gaza, and that uses discrimination and military power on the West Bank and the occupied 1948 territories? Why is American politicians recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and recognizing this annexation plan of Israel while there are several United Nations resolutions that say the annexation of Jerusalem is illegal and it is considered occupation?
I hope listeners will take up that challenge. There's a lot that we can and need to do.
I would just really emphasize that now is the time. We in the Palestinian community and in Jerusalem, we have seen how when Palestinians are united, even in the diaspora, when the international community has its eyes on Palestine, good things happen to the Palestinian people. Please don't wait for a Gaza war to happen or a prisoner to be on hunger strike and at imminent risk of sudden death at any moment. Don't wait till Palestinians are at their lowest in order for you to really stand up and take proactive action. Let's unite together. Let's do this unity until liberation for the Palestinian people, and not only because for the Palestinian people, but for the globalization of human rights, the need to respect the people's right to self-determination, the need to acknowledge the indigenous people all across the world, and the need to hold governments, occupying powers, and dictatorships accountable for their constant violations of basic human rights.
That was Melina Ansari, International Advocacy Officer for Adamir. Stay tuned next week for part two of her discussion with Ken Yale as they zero in on the Israeli judicial system and the collective resistance of Palestinian political prisoners. Jobran Massar. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Ethiopia's ongoing civil war began when the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, commonly known as the TPLF, attacked Ethiopia's northern command based in the country's Tigray region on November 3rd, 2020. The TPLF are a long-standing U.S. ally who ruled Ethiopia with an iron fist from 1991 until they were overthrown by a popular uprising which brought Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed to power in 2018. Pacifica's Ann Garrison reports from Ethiopia's Afar region, which the TPLF has invaded and occupied twice since the war began.
Valerie Browning, founder of the Afar Pastoralist Development Association, is a legendary Australian nurse known locally as Malaika, who has lived among the Afar Desert Pastoralists since the famine of 1973. She described the TPLF's horrific destruction of Afar communities, markets, health centers, schools, mosques, and livestock, and said that what the TPLF couldn't steal, they destroyed. She didn't hesitate to blame U.S. and Western support for the TPLF for the catastrophe that Afar has been left in, with hundreds of thousands of destitute Afaris living in IDP camps or still in the desert lands they fled into to escape the TPLF.
If the Western world had not put their hand in at the beginning of the war, we wouldn't be in this mess today. So they interfered from the very beginning. They agreed with the TPLF. They allowed the TPLF. At the same time, the TPLF fighting was going on. Suffering and hardship had begun in Afar. They only started talking about the suffering and hardship at the Afar about 6 weeks ago. And that's when the first journalists were allowed to come here.
Browning also dismissed the U.S. position that the TPLF is one warring party that should negotiate to reach some sort of shared power arrangement. The people of Tigray region should have a voice in parliament, she said, but the TPLF should not return to power after all the damage they have done in their war on Afar and other parts of Ethiopia.
I think the American position is still that TPLF should be in government, and this is not going to go. The people of Tigray should have a space in the parliament of Ethiopia, the same as any people of the country, but not the TPLF. No. Wait a minute. Let's be fair.
Browning said she had expected the TPLF, armed with tanks and artillery, to reach Samarra, where her organization is based, but that the legendary Afari fighters, armed only with Kalashnikovs, had driven them back. The Afari people, she said, are committed to the unity of the Ethiopian nation, but she doesn't know how much more they can withstand if the TPLF attack again.
Afar believe in the nation of Ethiopia. They try to keep the nation, and they want Ethiopia to be one country. They want Ethiopia to succeed, to have economy. This is, if you like, the jugular vein, this road from Djibouti, because it's bringing imports and exports. They're trying hard, but if TPLF come back again, it's too bad, because they've hurt Afar so badly with this livelihood. I don't know what we can do. I really don't know. Afar need food. They need water supply, clean water supply. They need medical help. They need anything. And if the TPLF come back and do dangerous destruction again, then Afar is in a shocking condition.
In Afar region, Ethiopia, for Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
Discredited and abandoned. Well, everywhere is war. It's your war. And until there's no longer first class or second class citizens of any nation, until the color of a man's skin is of no more significance to the color of his eyes, I've got to say. Morality will remain.
classic by Bob Marley, War. As the war in Ukraine enters its third month, and countries like Finland and Sweden discuss joining the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the risk of a world war escalates. Ed Fallon of the Fallon Forum spoke to Jeffrey Wise, a professor at Des Moines Area Community College, and Kathleen McQuillan, the director of Catholic Peace Ministry. Both have been engaged in peace and justice work since the last millennium. Here is part of their conversation.
Today, we're recording this program, is Victory Day in Russia, which, of course, used to be the day that Russia remembered its victory, if you can call it a victory where you lose, what, 20 million people, over Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. And then kind of became a day of peace, recognizing the importance of peace. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that a fair description?
Yeah, I think that this day is important for many reasons, but one of those reasons is the reality that when we think of the Russian Federation today, I think where we have to start is this is a country that three times in the last 100 years has suffered major cataclysms. A couple of times the state has collapsed, the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, and of course the disintegration of the Soviet Empire in 1990. And so, to the late Stephen Cohen, who is a Russian expert from Princeton, talks about how you really can't understand the modern day Russian Federation unless you understand this history, or even the rise of Vladimir Putin. And so, yeah, it's a significant day. What Cohen used to describe as the myth makers of Hollywood, or I tend to call it Hollyweird, in their commemorations and their movies related to World War II, what is left out is what everybody knows, is that the Soviets defeated the Germans in Europe. Of course, the United States contributed to the win in the Pacific. And when you think about a death total of 25 to 27, 28 million people,
That's just in the at the time Russia.
That would be Soviets.
Within
the former Soviet Union. Cohen describes it when he studied it as a village of 118-year-olds go off to war and maybe 12 of them return. This is important for understanding the context of what has taken place between Russia and Ukraine, because and even Pope Francis has weighed in on this, NATO's encirclement of the Russian Federation recently. For the first time in Russia's history since 1941, their western flank was filled with Western artillery. The entire might of the Cold War alliance was built right up to Russia's border, which a 10-year-old would understand that could be problematic. And many people understand that it was. Having said all that, I always have to say that the invasion of Ukraine is a sovereign state according to the United Nations Charter. This is an unlawful use of force. And all the rules of war apply the Russian Federation.
Yeah, so
but the history here is very important.
You mentioned Pope Francis and his position on NATO, and I thought that was interesting. I'd like at this point to bring Kathleen McQuillan into the conversation. Kathleen's on the phone with us. She is the director of the Catholic Peace Ministry. Kathleen, first, a bunch more questions for you, but first, the perspective on the Pope's comments about NATO relevant to the invasion of Ukraine.
Yeah, I was very pleased to see that, coming from, working for the Catholic Peace Ministry, and to see the Pope speak out and give some words that I think academics, international scholars like John Mearsmeer and peace groups have been saying for a long time, we should be looking at the role of NATO. Now, for him to say it, and he said it very cautiously because he's clearly hoping to be able to play a role in peacemaking and bringing the sides together. So his language was, delicate but important. It was, there may be, a role in this conflict in the NATO's expansion. And so it raises a question. I hope it raises a question for people around the world. So we feel good about that. And I think there's other voices beginning to get some airtime that we need to be attentive to.
And now, Kathleen, we're also seeing, of course, Finland and Sweden talking about wanting to join NATO. Is that kind of the opposite direction than the Pope and a lot of us would want to see NATO go?
Well, it would seem to me it is, but it also seems to me that it may now make sense for those two countries since, you know, they're seeing this violence taking place right now and the potential for greater violence if NATO expands its role or if the United States expands its role, including by continuing to send more and more weapons to face the Russians.
So I'm confused. Maybe, Jeffrey, you jump in as well. It seems to me like if NATO were to expand to include Sweden and especially Finland right on Russia's western border, that would be a huge provocation.
Yeah, I hope that both Sweden and Finland do not join NATO. NATO isn't a raise your hand, we want to be part of NATO club. It isn't as if countries can raise their hand and say, we want to be part of NATO. And all the countries in NATO would need to bring those countries in because they would feel that it would enhance their security. So obviously, the United States and other countries do not think that Russia is a threat to Sweden, to Finland. Otherwise, they wouldn't be inviting them into NATO. in this similar vein is why they didn't bring Ukraine into NATO ever. But what the United States did, in fact, is rather than Ukraine join NATO, NATO started joining Ukraine. In other words, during the Trump administration, the weapons that were sold. And the same thing you have with the $11 billion of weapons that were sold to Poland. So for the first time, Russia had artillery that could hit St. Petersburg that was in Poland that was given by the United States.
NATO has artillery that could hit St. Petersburg.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I mean, these aren't even missiles. This is artillery. Now, so think of what would happen if Russia put weapons in Cuba, if Russia put
threatened to, like back in the 60s under the Kennedy administration.
Absolutely. Right, yeah. Or, you know,
we know what happened.
Well, and what's also interesting about this is that a couple of months ago, Russia publicly said they were interested in putting military infrastructure in Venezuela or Cuba. And the United States immediately reacted and used the word bluster.
Right.
You know, this is just bluster. And then threatened Russia, saying, if you do this, we will act decisively.
Right. So it's all the more reason why Sweden and especially Finland joining NATO would be a really, really bad call.
The question that we all kind of forget history is when the Warsaw Pact ended in 1990, what is the purpose of NATO? If you have a military alliance, which was described as to keep the Americans in, to keep the Germans down, and to keep the Russians out, you no longer have a former Soviet Union. So there's so many people who negotiated the fall of the Soviet Union, George Kennan and others, who when NATO wanted to expand, Kennan said this will be the most fateful error of United States foreign policy. And I think Kennan was prophetic, because now we have a situation where we're closer to nuclear war than ever. If we are honest about it, all of us even still to this day have to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of NATO? There is no more Soviet Union, other than to sell United States weapons.
Those were the voices of Jeffrey Wise, Des Moines area community college professor, and Kathleen McQuillan, director of Catholic Peace Ministry, in conversation with Ed Fallon of the Fallon Forum. Listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Next, Malcolm X El Hajj Malik El Shabazz was born Malcolm Little on May 19, 1925, in Omaha, Nebraska. His mother was the National Recording Secretary for the Garvey Movement, which had millions of members in the 20s and 30s. His father was a Baptist minister and chapter president of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, founded by Marcus Garvey. Malcolm began to study the teachings of the Nation of Islam leader, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, while in prison. As Malcolm X became internationally known as a leader, he too became a threat to the status quo and was unjustly targeted by J. Edgar Hoover and others. Learn more about Malcolm's life and work. Read the autobiography of Malcolm X by Alec Taylor and numerous books written by scholars from all over the world. Here's an excerpt of Malcolm from the Pacifica Archives.
Brother Malcolm, 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 Brother
Malcolm. Mr. Malcolm, now, you're right, of course, the black people are in the worst. They have had the worst coming. But isn't it also possible that if the white people, the poor people, the people down in my neighborhood, the white people, those that don't work, those that are on welfare, those that have nothing, and they got together too. And you help us, we'll help you. You help us get up there. You help us get rid of some of these people that are pressing down on us.
No, I say you should be just as active in your neighborhood as we're trying as you have been in our neighborhood.
All right, we get our neighborhood real hot. Everybody's going for something. We alone, there are too few of us. There are too many men up there with all their cop cars and everything.
That's what they're always telling you. Never let your enemy tell you how many of you there are. Never let the man that you're against form your opinion. This is a trick that's played on everyone who's oppressed. The first thing, an occupation, when you have a revolution in the country, the first thing you take over is the radio. And then you start telling the people that everybody, the war is over. And so all of them surrender. No, they believe that thing right there. And once they take that over, they start telling you where you are and where they are, and you fall right in line. It's plain thought control. The majority of the American people aren't segregationists. That the majority of the American people aren't imperialists. But the government is, the structure is, the power faction is. So, how then do all the majority go along with it? Because those who sit in power over the television, over the radio, and over the press is constantly telling those who are the masses how free they are. And how this they are and how that they are. A mistake is made on your part when you think that white people suffer the same as black people. Or as many Jews will say, well, we're a minority too. Or the Irish will say, well, we used to be a minority. No one's a minority like we are. They didn't need civil rights legislation to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take a civil war to solve any other minority problem. It didn't take Supreme Court decisions to solve any other minority problem or legislation. It takes none of that other kind of action to solve the minority problems of these other people. The only real minority in America is the Afro-American. Now, when white people, who are oppressed and poor, supposedly, but the poorest white person can go where the richest black person can go. It isn't only poverty of money that we're talking about. Poverty in spirit, poverty in freedom, poverty in equality, poverty in human dignity. This is the kind of poverty we're suffering from. So that the richest Negro in this country is still poor. When it comes to freedom, he's broke. When it comes to human dignity, he's broke. This is the kind of poverty we're talking about. So when you find white people who are poor, with all these doors that there are open to them, any door that you knock on, if you qualify, it'll open. So when you find a poor white person, he's in bad shape.
Crooked game of power politics here in America. The Negro, namely the race problem, integration, civil rights issues, are all nothing but tools used by the whites who call themselves liberals against another group of whites who call themselves conservatives, either to get into power or to retain power. Among whites here in America, the political teams are no longer divided into Democrats and Republicans. The whites who are now struggling for control of the American political throne are divided into liberal and conservative camps. The white liberals from both parties cross party lines to work together toward the same goal. And white conservatives from both parties do likewise. The white liberal differs from the white conservative only in one way. The liberal is more deceitful, more hypocritical than the conservative. Both want power, but the white liberal is the one who has perfected the art of posing as the Negro's friend and benefactor. And by winning the friendship and support of the Negro, the white liberal is able to use the Negro as a pawn or a weapon in this political football game that is constantly raging between the white liberals and the white conservatives. The American Negro is nothing but a political football, and the white liberals control this ball through tricks or tokenism, false promises of integration and civil rights. In this game of deceiving and using the American Negro, the white liberals have complete cooperation of the Negro civil rights leader, who sell our people out for a few crumbs of token recognition, token gain, token progress.
That was Archie Shepp and Khalil El-Sabah's Ritual Trio, Brother Malcolm. After repeated attempts on his life, Malcolm traveled with bodyguards on February 14, 1965. The home where Malcolm, Betty, and their four daughters lived in New York was firebombed. 1 week later, at a speaking engagement in the Audubon Ballroom in New York City, on February 21, 1965, three gunmen shot Malcolm 15 times at close range. He was pronounced dead on arrival at New York's Columbia Presbyterian Hospital at 39 years old. Today, we salute Malcolm and his contributions to humanity.
Ahmaud Arbery, you went for a run because you probably felt free. Ahmaud Arbery, your run had an end that nobody could see. Little black boys don't run outside or play with water guns at night. They run away from red and white, blue light. Stores or use their pockets anymore. Can someone tell them what they're living for? They want more. Oh, Brian, the tailor, so peaceful and pure. Oh, Brian, the tailor, your peace was ended by police burglars. Oh, little black girls don't close their eyes or walk the streets alone at night. They turn their cameras on when they
girls are scared. Their parents feel so unprepared. The world sees black no matter what you wear.
So little black. We need more by Taylor Jalen Figgins. This is dedicated to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the countless black sisters and brothers who have died. Support Taylor Figgins' music online, which he says is a place where adventure, creativity, and life become one single endeavor. He performed this piece on American Idol in February 2022. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Pauline Basilio, Steve Zeltzer, and Akua Holt. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. I have no mercy or compassion in me for a society that will crush people and then penalize them for not being able to stand up under the weight.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York. I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The United States has reached 1 million reported deaths from COVID-19, according to figures from the CDC. The tragic milestone comes just 2.5 years into the pandemic. And while the daily toll of COVID-19 deaths in the country has slowed in recent months, that could soon change. On May 4th, for the first time in months, the CDC warned it predicted the pace of new COVID-19 deaths would, quote, likely increase nationwide over the coming weeks. The U.S. has had more deaths per capita than Western Europe or Canada. As the Associated Press reports, 3 out of every 4 deaths were of people 65 and older. More men died than women. Black, Hispanic, and Native American people have been roughly twice as likely to die from COVID-19 as their white counterparts. It is also expected that the U.S., like other countries, has undercounted the true number of deaths from the coronavirus. The average number of new U.S. cases climbed above 91,000 today, a more than 50% increase since 2 weeks ago. The northeastern U.S., led by Rhode Island, is experiencing the largest per capita case rate increase of any region, according to the New York Times. Nationally, hospitalizations are up over 20% since 2 weeks ago, while a gradual reduction in death rates has tapered off. The number of COVID patients in ICUs has increased 15% over 2 weeks. New York City is averaging over 4,300 new cases each day, out of over 10,000 new cases statewide. Maryland and Virginia have experienced case rate increases of 84% and 74%, respectively. Swedish Prime Minister Magdalena Andersson announced yesterday that her party, the Social Democrats, had decided that Sweden should join the NATO military alliance. Her party voted in a meeting yesterday to support working toward applying to join the Western Military Alliance, setting up a vote in Parliament. Just hours earlier, Finland formally announced that it too would seek to join NATO. Andersson said Sweden's military non-alliance had served it well for 200 years, but Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine showed the policy, quote, will not serve us well in the future, end quote. The invasion demonstrated that the Kremlin is, quote, prepared to use violence to achieve their political objectives and that they don't hesitate to take enormous risks, Andersson said. Turkey, which is a member of NATO, had voiced concern over Finland and Sweden joining the military alliance, but it is not expected to veto their membership. Turkey has long accused Sweden of supporting the PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, which is banned in Turkey. In domestic news, the Biden White House is expected to announce an agreement to reopen the country's largest infant formula manufacturing plant and ease import rules on the products amid a nationwide shortage. The shortage came after safety issues forced shutdowns at a plant in Michigan earlier this year. Brian D.